Winter camping in Wisconsin sounds a bit crazy, but I promise you, when I did it last year, the 28-degree temperature felt balmy. I went with my Journal Sentinel colleagues Ashley Lutheran and Chelsea Lewis. We'll hear from the two of them later in the show as Ashley talks to Chelsea about a local man who has spent more than 200 nights winter camping. This is Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks for listening. Also coming up in today's show, we'll hear from editorial editors David Haynes and Ernie Franzen. They discuss their recent editorial calling for Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark to resign. We'll also hear from our business intern this summer, Rebecca Carballo. Rebecca has a story on a program that helps Milwaukee teens learn trade skills. The state of Wisconsin's youth prison complex in Irma, 30 miles north of Wausau, includes the Lincoln Hill School for Boys and the Copper Lake School for Girls. It seems that almost every recent news story about the complex centers on investigations into the abuse of inmates. Most of the news has been about Lincoln Hills, but now more is being learned about severe problems that have also been found at the girls' facility, Copper Lake. This past week, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit alleging that guards in both facilities frequently used pepper spray on teen inmates who broke minor rules. Both facilities have continued a practice of extensively using solitary confinement. And now Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Patrick Marley, who has been breaking most of the news, has a story about Copper Lake and one inmate in particular, Sydney Briggs. Marley's story describes how Briggs was found hanging from a door hinge with a noose made from a T-shirt. She was not breathing and had no pulse. She survived. But after 4 months in a coma, Briggs is now in a rehabilitation center. She can't walk and has trouble feeding herself. She has the mental capacity of a child. Journal Sentinel staff reporter Tom Kircher talks with Marley about his story.
Patrick, I wonder if we could start by having you tell us about Sydney Briggs. How old is she? Where is she from? And why was she an inmate at Copper Lake?
So she's 18 now. She just turned 18 in December. She was 16 in the summer of 2015 when she was sent to Copper Lake. She had been in trouble, had broken into a liquor store with a friend and stolen some bottles of liquor. A judge sent her initially to a group home and an alcohol treatment facility. She ran away from those places, and so then he sent her in July of 2015 to Copper Lake.
And then the story you're writing about focuses a lot on the hanging incident. When did that occur, and can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So I think it's important to know some of the lead-up to that. She was there in July, and within a couple of months, they had incidents where she had scratched her arm so severely that they bled. She said she did that out of anxiety and depression. She disclosed for the first time while she was there that she'd had a traumatic experience in her childhood that she was coming to terms with and coping with. By October, she was seeing a psychiatrist there and told the psychiatrist that she sometimes had suicidal thoughts, sometimes viewed life as hopeless, said she wouldn't act on those, but that she did have those thoughts. After that, she was not put on any special monitoring. And about 2 weeks after that happened, she chewed her cheeks out of anxiety so much that they bled, spat on a table, and the response from the institution was to put her into solitary confinement. From there, she was at some point transferred to a mental health wing. And then on November 9th, 2015, turned on the call light, alerting guards that she wanted someone to come to her. By the time they got there, she was hanging, had no pulse, was not breathing. We don't know how much time passed between the time the light was turned on and they found her.
And I know your story goes into what she's gone through since then. Do we have a sense for what her prognosis is going forward?
Well, so the guards got there and called the other guards, called a nurse, called 911, began using CPR, used a defibrillator. and got her back with a heartbeat. She was taken to a pediatric unit in Marshfield, and her mom was informed and came there, and for the next 9 days, her mom didn't know if she was going to live or die. The mother was told that, you know, if she did emerge from the coma that she was in, that she may be in a vegetative state, or, you know, or she might not ever emerge from the coma, and if she did, she would not have a quality life. Considering where she was, she's made a pretty miraculous recovery, but she's, you know, very severely brain damaged from the lack of blood and oxygen. I had a chance to meet her. She's in a wheelchair. She has muscle spasms. It's, you know, she speaks in sort of a childlike wonder. She's 18 years old now, but in many ways it's like talking to a child of 6 or 7, working on her brain development, working on her motor skills, but she's going to need around-the-clock care for the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm. Sydney's story is obviously compelling, but I wonder if we could turn to some of the larger questions that episode raises. But how did we learn about the hanging incident involving her? And then do we know whether any staff failed to follow proper procedures in that incident?
So the newspaper first learned about that something had happened about 2 weeks after it happened in November of 2015. And contacted the Department of Corrections. This wasn't me, this was another reporter, and said, I think the initial report we got that was that someone had died, because at that time they really believed that Sydney was not going to live. And that all the Department of Corrections would say is, we have no reports of suicides at Copper Lake recently. So while it may be true that there was not a suicide in the sense that someone died, there certainly was a very serious suicide attempt that had very grave consequences. Some months after that, we learned a few details, and that it was very serious and that she had survived. And we've reported on that a couple of times. You know, I spent some time a year ago trying to find family, was unsuccessful at that point, but eventually we came to learn about this and get in touch with her mother and the attorney, and are now able to tell this story. To your question about Sydney Briggs' mother, and on her behalf, is going to sue the Department of Corrections. They're going to be contending that warning signs were missed, things were not done that were proper, that were improper. Their contention is that she should have been on much closer monitoring, given that she had harmed herself in the past and all the warnings she was giving, such as by revealing this very traumatic thing from her past and saying that she was thinking of suicide.
And Patrick, do you know whether Copper Lake, the facility, has taken any action or changed any procedures in response to what happened to Sydney Briggs?
In response to that particular incident, I guess we don't know that. You know, Copper Lake is on the same grounds as Lincoln Hill School for Boys. Copper Lake's a much smaller facility, holds between 20 and 35 inmates on any given day, whereas there may be 150 or more boys at Lincoln Hill School. Both facilities now, for more than 2 years, have been under a criminal investigation for child neglect, child abuse, and a number of other potential crimes. In response to that, last year, the Governor Scott Walker's administration began making a number of changes to how the facilities operate. You know, those include everything from having nurses give out medicine rather than having guards do it, more training for guards, which would include how to respond to the signs of problems with mental health.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could close, Patrick, with a little more of a personal question. You've been reporting on incidents at the two youth prisons, Lincoln Hills, Copper Lake, for quite a while now. You have a daughter. Has this been difficult for you personally to write about all this time?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, you hear this case, this situation is particularly sad, and unfortunately, many of the things that are going on at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake are very sad. And, you know, the kids there are really young. You hear about 14, 15, 16-year-old girls and boys who've had very tough upbringings and then have experienced some really rough things there at Lincoln Hills. So, you know, my daughter's 11. You know, you look at her in a different way and you think, you know, there but for the grace of God, right? You don't know. It's tough on anybody covering this stuff.
No doubt. Well, thanks for all your reporting on this. Thanks for sharing some of your personal thoughts as well. This has been Tom Kircher of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with Patrick Marley, one of our reporters in our Madison Bureau. Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Find Patrick's story in print and online Sunday. You can also find past coverage of the crisis at Lincoln Hills at jsonline.com/Lincoln Hills. Again, that's jsonline.com/Lincoln Hills. When people think of camping in Wisconsin, clear summer nights or crisp autumn evenings probably come to mind. But more and more, people are giving winter camping a try. Winter camping is a low-cost way to enjoy our state's natural areas without the usual summer crowds. Wisconsin Trails reporter Chelsea Lewis talks with Ashley Lutheran about tips for winter camping and why more Wisconsinites should give it a try.
So Chelsea, this week for Day Out, you wrote about winter camping. Last year, we both went winter camping for the first time, and it was surprisingly not terrible. We survived. We did not freeze. But I wanted to hear from you in the column now that you are the expert. What are some of the tips for winter camping that we should all be aware of?
Yeah. I don't know if I'd consider myself an expert, but I did talk to an expert, this guy named Nick Gordon. He runs kind of an outdoor educational company, and he teaches some introduction to winter camping classes through a meetup group he has, and then he does some other wilderness survival stuff. So I think one thing he said, and I agree with, is that a lot of people think that to go winter camping, you need all this pricey, expensive gear and like all this training, and you need to be a crazy outdoors person. But that's totally not the case. You can do something as simple as like if you only have a summer sleeping bag, you know, it's only maybe rated to 50 degrees, use two sleeping bags and that'll do the trick. He said he's taken some college students and they'll just use like carpet pads as sleeping pads. You can double up on sleeping pads. You really don't need a four-season tent. In fact, in Wisconsin, we have relatively high humidity in the winter. So if you do use a four-season tent, those tend to not have the best ventilation because they're trying to trap your heat in there. They're a little bit stronger for the elements and this possible snow. So they kind of trap moisture, which will condense and then freeze. And then you kind of get this snowing inside of the tent effect, which is not fun. You don't want to wake up to that.
No.
So, yeah, you don't really need a ton of expensive gear and stuff. You just kind of have to be willing to try. And it is advisable to go with someone who maybe has gone before. We went with your husband who has been winter camping. So that was really nice that he kind of has had a little experience doing that kind of thing. But if you've been summer camping or shoulder season camping, you can totally go winter camping too.
And you mentioned Nick Gordon, who you interviewed for this piece. How did you meet him? And could you describe a little bit more about his background and what Meetup is?
Sure, yeah. I kind of got in touch with him through Meetup. Meetup is an online website. There are different groups with specific interests that form, and then these groups within Meetup kind of will schedule different events to meet up, if you will. So there are like running clubs, and you know, if you're into knitting, there are knitting clubs, and there are a lot of outdoors and wilderness clubs. So he runs kind of a wilderness adventure club in Milwaukee and hosts these different events. And yeah, he's a really interesting guy because he grew up in the Milwaukee area in Brown Deer. But he didn't really get into backpacking and kind of, I guess, what you would call more extreme camping and outdoor stuff until he was in college. Like a lot of people in Wisconsin, his family has a cabin up north, so he kind of fell in love with the outdoors out there and did some scouting and stuff like that. But didn't really get into, yeah, like I said, big outdoor stuff until he was in college. So I think that's really cool because a lot of people, I think, are intimidated to get involved in outdoor stuff when they're a little older because there aren't scouting groups for adults or, you know, summer camps for adults. Well, there are now, but, you know, it's a little harder and a little more intimidating to start when you're an adult. So when he teaches these classes, he comes from that perspective. So, and he said he teaches everyone from college students to, you know, older seniors. So it's totally for everyone.
That's something I really have to agree with. Growing up, my family was not one to go camping. And mm-hmm. actually, my husband was the one who introduced me to camping and, mm-hmm. you know, the whole sleeping bag, pitching a tent. And it is it's enriched my life a lot, I would say. And I think if you ask a lot of people who picked it up later in life, they would probably say the same.
Totally.
So what are the selling points? What are the benefits of going winter camping?
Well, I think you and I both agree that no bugs is huge. No
huge.
Mosquitoes, no spiders, no, you know, ticks in northern Wisconsin. So that's a big selling point. One thing for me is that it's just so much quieter. State parks in Wisconsin are really popular in the summer. Yay, great, I love that. But if you're looking for a little more solitude, you know, that's a little harder to find. So we went to Colorandre last year, which is just packed in the summer. I mean, you can't get a reservation for a campsite on the weekend. But we just drove up there on a Saturday in the winter and got a campsite when we got there. I think there was maybe like, what, one or two other people there camping. Yeah, we had the trails pretty much to ourselves. So that's a really big perk as well. If you don't like being hot and sticky, as it can be in the summer in Wisconsin, I mean, that's great in winter. You can always add layers if you're chilly, but it's a little hard to take off layers sometimes when it gets really warm in Wisconsin. So that's another perk, too. And it's just like a new way to see the state. You know, Colorandre looks a lot different in the winter than it does in the summer. Still beautiful, but a totally different kind of beauty. So I really love that as well.
Absolutely. And my husband would be remiss if I didn't point this out. While you're wearing all of your layers in the winter, be careful not to be too warm, because if you start to sweat, then you get cold and clammy, and that's bad. That's the you absolutely want to avoid that,
for
if
sure.
at all possible.
Yeah, that is such great advice, because I think a lot of people assume they're going to be really cold, so they throw on a ton of layers, and then all of a sudden you start making camp. You know, you look for firewood, you're cutting firewood, you're cooking, you're just moving around snowshoeing or doing
hiking.
Yeah, and all of a sudden you start sweating, and then you slow down again, and that sweat is cold, because that's what sweat is meant to do, is cool you down, and then you get cold. So, yeah, I think one good piece of advice Nick gave was wool is your best friend. Like, none of these fancy fabrics. I mean, those are fine. But wool,
the synthetic ones are okay, but wool is the way to go.
Good old-fashioned wool. It repels moisture, and it keeps you warm. And, you know, you can just pick up some, like, Goodwill sweaters or pants at Goodwill.
And that is, for all listeners out there, that is exactly what my husband wore. He went to Goodwill, and I joked that he almost looked like he was going to church, because he came back with these, like, hardy khaki pants and bunch of wool sweaters that were crew cut and looked kind of preppy.
Yeah.
But they kept him really warm.
Exactly.
They were exactly what he was looking for, and frankly, they were worth the, you know, $10 investment that he made in them.
Right, absolutely.
So, all right, Chelsea, well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about winter camping.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Read Chelsea's Day Out column about winter camping in the Journal Sentinel this weekend and at jsonline.com. To quote our editorial board, "It's becoming ever clearer that Milwaukee County voters need to start looking for a new sheriff, and the sooner, the better." Editorial editors David Haynes and Ernie Franzen wanted to join today's show to explain their rationale behind their words. Here's their chat.
So this is Dave Haynes, opinions editor at the Journal Sentinel, and I'm here with
Ernie Franzen.
Ernie Franzen, and we're here to talk about Milwaukee County Sheriff David A. Clark Jr. Now, Ernie, Clark is a big supporter of President Trump, and sometimes it looks like, to me at least, like he majored in political coarseness at Trump University.
He did.
We called on Clark to resign this week, or failing that, for competent candidates to step up to oppose him when he runs again in 2018. So, Ernie, take us back. Talk about what pushed us over the edge on our editorial page to finally split with the so-called sheriff of Milwaukee County.
We've actually been split with him for a while now. But I think the latest, look at some of the things that happened last year. There were four deaths at the jail. He has not shown any concern for explaining those deaths, for telling the public or even the families what happened in those cases. Information has come out from other sources. He called up the medical examiner's office and yelled at them for releasing any information on one of the cases.
And a couple of the deaths are really egregious, at least if you believe what we know so far. You had this one man.
And the problem is,
who apparently died of thirst.
Yeah, these deaths occurred in public custody. The public has a right to know how and why that happened. And in lieu of any information from the sheriff's office, they're left to speculate, and the speculation is that things have been bad. So he needs to answer those questions. He's shown no interest in doing so. In addition to that, his behavior in social media, Facebook, Twitter, has been inappropriate. He has called a CNN commentator a racial slur. There was this incident at the airport recently with a guy who says that all he did was shake his head at the sheriff, and then walk away.
He was on a flight, and then after he got off the flight, he was escorted out of the airport.
When he gets to Milwaukee, he is questioned, he says, by sheriff's deputies. That's an abuse of power.
Yeah, if that's true, there's no doubt that's an abuse of power.
You are allowed to disagree with officials, to criticize them, to look sideways at them under our system.
And we've also been critical of his frequent out-of-state travel, right, to do things that have nothing to do with being a sheriff in Milwaukee County.
He spent a week in Washington over the inauguration, from what I understand. So, you know, fine if he wants to take vacation time to do that, but there are impressing concerns here back in Milwaukee. I don't think he's doing his job.
Yeah, and so our take is that he likes to be called America's sheriff, but that's not what we elected him to do. We elected him to be the Milwaukee County sheriff. So, I'm sure there's a reality TV show out there somewhere that would have him, but we're pretty much done with Sheriff David Clark in Milwaukee County.
You know, and if the Trump administration can give him a job somewhere far away from Milwaukee where he can't do any damage, that's perfect.
We might be okay with that. Otherwise, we would look for competent candidates to stand against David Clark in 2 years.
Yep.
All right. So that's Dave and Ernie on the opinion page and why we decided to take on Sheriff David Clark of Milwaukee County.
Thanks a lot.
That editorial already appeared in print in the Journal Sentinel. To find it online, visit jsonline.com/opinion. There's a growing need for trade-skilled workers. Building to Learn Consortium is hoping to address that need. The consortium partnered with All Hands Boat Works to create a training program for Milwaukee teens. In this program, participants learn trade skills by crafting 12-foot wooden boats. Here for the first time is business intern Rebecca Carballo talking to business editor Jim Nelson.
Hi, I'm Jim Nelson of the Journal Sentinel, and I'm here with Journal Sentinel business reporter Rebecca Carballo, and we're here to talk about a story she has upcoming about an interesting partnership between schools and boat building. What's your story about?
So it's about these two nonprofits coming together that are teaching kids how to build boats, but it's not just for fun. It's not just an after-school or during-school activity. It's so they can learn important trade skills that we're really lacking in the industries.
So trade skills, like what kind of skills?
Carpentry, if you're a mason, things like that, construction work.
How to use tools and how to maybe correct mistakes if you make mistakes along the way while you build a boat. Is that
right, exactly. That's part of it. They have to learn like applied mathematics, team building, all those types of things.
I suppose if you don't have team building or if you measure the wrong way, bad things could happen to your boat.
Yes, definitely. I was talking to some of the students, and one of them, when they were looking back on it, they were very upset when they had to remember, oh, yeah, we measured wrong, and the part of the boat just cracked, and we had to start over.
Yeah.
So it also teaches you a little bit of resilience, I bet.
It's the old rule of carpentry, which is measure twice and then cut once, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what schools are these nonprofits working with? Are they in specific a number of different schools, right?
Yeah, it's a number of different schools in Milwaukee. I went to the showcase for the one with Pulaski High School and Carmen School of Sciences and Technology.
So these are upper level students. These are high school age type students.
Yes, it's high schools.
And how many kids work on each boat?
The group I saw was about 8 kids.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And what kind of work did you see them doing when you were there? Were they sawing or nailing stuff together?
When I was there, the boat was all together. They had it built and ready to go. They were painting. So they were in the last stages. It was very impressive.
Wow. And do you think the kids are learning these skills? Do you think it's an effective program? Did it seem like it was working?
I think the boat that was in front of me testifies that it works. They built a 12-foot, like, wooden rowboat, a skiff, if we to use the technical term.
Uh-huh.
So it looked good. I think they did a great job, and they were really enthusiastic when they talked about it, and they really seemed like they knew what they were talking about.
And what are the groups that are doing this? There's two different nonprofits, right?
Right. So it's B2L, Building to Learn,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is All Hands on Boat Works.
And is that's the company that's the boat part of the
yes,
equation
Yes, that's the
here.
Boat part. B2L is really looking into getting youth interested in pursuing careers, or at least opening their eyes to looking at a career in the skilled trades.
And they've been doing this for a while, haven't they? There's in previous seasons or previous years?
Yeah, they've had previous years. I think the partnership is relatively new.
And the boat that you saw, can you describe it a little bit more? What's a skiff?
It's this flat, like the bottom is flat. It's a wooden boat. And it kind of looks like sort of a rowboat is how I thought it looked like, what it looked like.
So it doesn't have a sail and all that.
No sail.
You can't water ski behind it.
No sail, no motor. Yeah. You have to paddle. But when they launch it, that'll be fun for them.
And where will they be launching it? And I assume it's not going to be anytime soon.
No, a little too cold for that. They are projecting to launch it in either April or May at Menominee Valley.
And along the river there in the valley, it's yes. you mentioned earlier that there are other boats there. Are these boats available for – could you and I go and rent a boat or borrow one and try it out? Do you know if that's the case there?
I'm not sure. That is an excellent question.
And the most important question is, when they do launch their boat, what do you think? Would you get in it and take it for a row? Do you think they've built a seaworthy craft?
I think they did. They sold me on it. I trust them.
Sounds like a really interesting program and a really interesting story. Thank you very much.
For interested readers, Rebecca's story is scheduled to run in today's paper. It's also available at jsonline.com/business. And so ends today's show. Thanks once again for listening to Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, and I urge you to go winter camping this weekend. I promise you'll love it.